is Dolores Cannon again with the Metaphysical Hour, and I'm glad everybody could join us tonight. I do want to say that last week I didn't do the show, and they had to take one from the archives because I was in Montreal, and I was at an ashram up there, yoga teacher's training. So it's pretty hard to do a show when you're out of touch, no telephones, no computers or anything. So they had to pull one out of the archives anyway. Okay, let me give out the toll-free number in case anyone does want to call in. It is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. Before I get to my guest, I do want to tell everyone we're making the final plans, and I will be in New Zealand and Australia the entire month of October and the first 2 weeks in November. And anybody wants information about that, go to my website, www.OzarkMT.com, and you'll be able to find the schedule of what I'll be doing over there, Australia and New Zealand. Okay. Now, tonight, our guest is Dr. Tony Chapdelaine. Now, many of you before on the show have known that I have talked a lot about natural healing. And in my work, I get a lot of people who do have physical problems, and I've been trying to steer them over toward the natural healing, the homeopaths and the naturopaths. And so to me, it's something that I really believe in because I do it myself. So I met Dr. Chapdelaine several months ago, and he was telling me about his work, which I think is very interesting, fantastic, and very useful. I'm going to let him explain it, but it deals with natural healing. But he said one of his main focuses is autism. And he told me some very remarkable things about what they're doing with autism. So we're going to spend the hour with Dr. Chapdelaine. Okay, Tony, you there?
I'm here. Thanks, Dolores.
Okay. I want them to tell me a little bit about yourself. You are a medical doctor, and what you decided to leave the traditional?
Yes, I'm a board-certified preventive medicine physician, and was interested before I went to medical school, which was back in the mid-80s, in doing something along the natural, more holistic method. And what I ended up with was basically going through medical school, but also learning along the way other ways of approaching health instead of just using the standard drugs for symptoms approach.
Yeah.
And so consequently, I've done a lot over the years, but the last 3.5, almost 4 years now, I've been in my own clinic working with people using primarily a natural approach, vitamins, supplements, energy methods, different ways of approaching helping people help themselves to become healed again. So that's where we are now. And part of that is, as you mentioned, focusing a lot or have been on autism almost from the beginning. That's a epidemic at this point. And
yes, that's what I keep hearing, that it's an epidemic out there, and it doesn't make sense because why would it appear so suddenly?
Well, you're right. It wasn't 30, 40 years ago, maybe one out of 2,500 children were in the autism spectrum. Now it's about one out of 125 to 150.
And that seems very out of proportion. If it was going to happen naturally.
You're right. There's no rational reason for this as far as finding new cases that maybe we didn't recognize it. That's not the case. This is a real epidemic. There's no doubt.
Do you want to offer what you think is causing it? Now, we discussed it, and They told me on this show we can talk about anything. We don't have to worry about anything controversial.
Well, good. There are some controversies surrounding it. There's the standard medical approach to this, which is and has been used for years, and not very effectively, trying different drugs to handle the behaviors of the children. Autism, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's a very serious and severe disability for an infant or a child. It may appear near birth or within the first 2 years of life, usually.
Yeah.
The symptoms can range from communication problems, not able to express themselves, maybe repeating themselves over and over, or repeating or echoing what someone else said. They have many, many issues with sensory confusion, withdraw from humans often, injure themselves or hit themselves or do self-stimulating behaviors like tapping teeth constantly. So it's a very impairing disability, socially especially. And these children are often said to be, if it's very severe, living in a world of their own. So
it's also difficult for the caretakers, too.
The parents are, especially if they have more than one, which does happen, have more than one child with this, quote, autistic personality or problem, then it becomes almost a 24-hour problem for the parents just to try to manage their children, much less do anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but do you want to say what you think the main cause of it has increased?
Right. So the causes, according to a lot of the research that Autism Research Institute itself has done, which Dr. Bernard Remlin started back in the 1960s, I think 1967. He was the first one. He's a psychologist, passed away last year. He was a psychologist who internationally known for his work in autism, and back at that time, the standard theory was that autism had to do with the subconscious rejection of a child by a mother. And Dr. Remlin thought that didn't make much sense, that it was more a biological problem. So he actually studied this. He had himself an autistic son and found that, indeed, there is a biological basis behind a lot of these behaviors, in fact, the vast majority of them. So it turns out from their research that there are primary types of problems that create these behaviors in the children stem from several directions. It's usually not just one problem or one thing causing it. Usually there are several that are just overwhelming the child early on.
Yeah.
I'll give you a quick summary of some of the main ones. One, a lot of these children they may or may not, but they have problems like with ear infections, or they're thought to be infections. They get antibiotics. The antibiotics kill a lot of the good bacteria in the intestine, which have a lot of jobs to do. One of them is absorbing B vitamins from the food, which are needed for brain thinking and biological chemicals. The yeast are created, take over once this happens, and now you have toxins that leak into the gut, from the gut into the blood. And these toxins are known to go to the brain and cause neurological problems. And so that's just one issue that precipitates some of these behaviors, because we've found many of the doctors who are doing this type of work, that if for a lot of the children, if you do nothing but start getting rid of the yeast in the intestine and replacing the good bacteria, the children start getting better, and sometimes almost overnight.
Most parents always think, you know, we give them an antibiotic, it's going to help them, but they are finding now that a lot of the antibiotics, too much, is hurting the kids.
You're right. And most of the physicians have not been trained to think in terms of yeast. So they always dispense these antibiotics thinking, well, you know, we got to get rid of some infection. And it may be helpful, but on the other hand, it can often be counterproductive. In this case, it would be for this child.
And like a lot of drugs, it kills the good along with the bad.
Yeah. It does two things at once. All drugs have some toxicity to them. We call them side effects, but they're all toxic. So the other issues that have been discovered are that the children, and even now, there are immunizations or vaccinations given to children. It's every year it seems that there are new ones that are added on, so that maybe by the time, if you take them individually, by the time a child's about 6 months old, they may have already been injected with 45 different vaccines.
Wow.
When you include something like MMR, which is measles, mumps, rubella, that's three different types.
Yeah.
But adding that up, by the time they're 4 or 6 years old, they've already had 74, maybe even more. So,
in the old days, we only had one or two.
That's right. Well, it turns out that these vaccinations, until within the last couple of years, when there was an outcry to the manufacturers, the CDC said, well, we do need to get the mercury out of these. Mercury was used as a preservative.
Yeah.
And, in fact, some of the vaccines still have mercury, as a matter of fact, such as the flu vaccine, among other toxins in there.
Yeah.
These children, some are just more susceptible to not, when you give these vaccinations, lots of them, to these little kids, and they're just infants and they're just born, and their immune systems are not developed, their brains are not fully developed, what happens is the mercury is an extremely potent toxin, just after radiation probably for toxicity. And you start injecting these into these little bodies. A lot of times this goes right to the brain and different organs and just settles there. And it also can accumulate from the environment. We're all exposed to heavy metals all the time. Lead, mercury, cadmium, arsenic, it's in the food and water supply. And so if you're just a little bit more genetically susceptible to not getting rid of these constantly out of the body, then they will accumulate. And that's what happens for some of these kids. So they now have another problem. They now have heavy metal or mercury poisoning.
Yeah, don't they also say that what's in the vaccinations now is not what we had when we were children?
It has almost nothing to do with what we got as children back in the 50s or even 60s. These are, if you look at the ingredients that are in some of these, it's quite amazing to look at it. I'm just looking at a couple right now. If you look at, say, the DPT, which is diphtheria and tetanus and pertussis vaccine, made by Smith, Kline, Beecham. They have aluminum in it, formaldehyde, which is embalming fluid, ammonium sulfate, washed sheep red blood cells, glycerol, sodium chloride, mercury preservative called thimerosal. It has pig pancreatic hydroxylate of casein. Anyway, those are examples. Almost every vaccine that's given has that kind of stuff in it.
But that isn't really needed, is it?
They think they're needed for preserving or to make the vaccine more effective, or sometimes it's because of the source of where you get the vaccine. It's usually grown in a culture or animal cells of different types. They can't get all those out, so some of them go into the vaccine with it.
Hmm.
And, well,
That's why the kids are getting a whole lot different thing than we used to.
That's right. It's very different. The next item that has been found that is very important for this is actually one of these vaccines, the MMR itself, the measles, mumps, rubella.
Yeah.
Many of these children, it's usually given around age 12 months to 15 months. That's typical. It's been found that the measles virus in the presence of the mumps virus, apparently in that vaccine, for some of these children, they are just, again, genetically in some fashion just not able to get rid of it like other children who get the vaccine. This measles virus then persists in the brain and the nerves in sort of a subclinical fashion and can just devastate them. I and other clinicians, doctors who have been doing this, have had patients time and again who report, my child was doing just fine. It had a large vocabulary, was running around, very lovable, hugging, and got the MMR shot about 12 months, and within two or three days wasn't speaking and basically was autistic from that time on.
Yeah, I've heard that too from several people.
And that is true.
Around 18 months, too, some of them say it happens then.
It just depends on when they get it in the child.
Yeah.
Sometimes it may delay for two or three months after the shot.
Hmm.
So it's obviously, now this is not considered true by the CDC and some others who are obviously promoting these vaccines and don't want people not to get them. However, the fact is this is what's happening.
Yeah, they're not going to admit those things are in there. They keep saying it won't hurt anybody.
Well, they can't. Sort of be like the tobacco lobby admitting that they cause cancer. They don't want to do that.
But, well, you know, I always tell people, we all had those. We had the mumps. We had the measles. We had all of those things. And it was common. It was like a rite of passage. You know, you had to get them when you were a child. Then it made you immune to many other things because it strengthened your immune system.
And you're right. You're absolutely right. If you look now, how many people have had chicken pox? We all had that as we were
growing up. Yeah, it was just something you just went through.
And yeah, there's occasionally someone would have a serious problem with that. And it's rare, but it happened. Now, however, children are almost automatically given these injections, which turns out are not as effective as they think they are, were going to be, so they don't even protect that well. Many times children or other people who are around them can pick up the infection.
I've also heard, too, that the shot can cause shingles, too, can't it?
Yeah, eventually. That's what happens with this particular, the chickenpox virus, whether it's from the shot or not. Some people, as their immune system is not as potent or goes down in effectiveness, then the virus can come back out of the nerves and cause what's called shingles.
Because for years I heard that they would never be able to have a vaccination against chickenpox because of the side effect of shingles.
Well,
now all of a sudden they've got one, and they were telling the doctors to push it. You know?
Yeah, it's every year there are new vaccines that the drug companies and others say, well, this is a wonderful idea. Let's try making a vaccine for that virus or some other problem.
Yeah,
and it just overwhelms the immune systems on these little children. They're not ready for this, and so you're hitting them all at once with these things. Let me mention one more major.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to go ahead.
This could go on for a long time. There's a lot going on in this field. I'm trying to summarize it somewhat. But the other factor is, if you look at, and this was found by the Autism Research Institute, and is quite interesting. If you look at the whole group, the autism spectrum as a whole, ranging from very severe up to very high-functioning children, Asperger's and other types of children with those kinds of symptoms, then you find that doing just one thing, if you get them off of milk and proteins and wheat gluten proteins, if you get them off of milk, wheat, and gluten, half of these children start getting better.
Hmm.
And the reason is because they are genetically just a little bit defective on an enzyme called DPP4. It's found on the white blood cells, and it's also in the intestine. one of the jobs of this particular enzyme in the intestine, in this case, is it's a digestive enzyme. It's supposed to help break up some of the proteins on the milk and the gluten, barley, rye, oats, wheat, spelt, we'll all have gluten, on those grains, break it up and so that they do not form other products. These products are basically opioids or dope. So these kids are sort of running around in a dope fog. It goes to the brain. And, and so,
Their bodies can't produce this so that it can digest the food the way they're supposed to.
That's right. They can't break it up as well. So the more of that they eat, the more dope they're on and the more fog they are and the less they're able to communicate. And so just getting them away from that and replacing that enzyme, for some kids, it just turns them around overnight. Others, it takes longer. Sometimes it's only partial. And again, it's usually many things going on at once rather than one item.
Yeah, something like that. It seems so simple, but sometimes the solutions are simple.
They are. That seems simple. Well, we find some parents are able to do this. They're able to help their children stay away from these kinds of foods. But if you look out, other parents really struggle with it because the child has kind of grown up with these foods. They like milk. They don't want to not have their wheat, their cereal, whatever. And you look out on the marketplace in the grocery stores, you'll find most of the products out there have wheat or gluten in them.
Yeah.
Very difficult to avoid. So just learning how to get the kinds of foods that don't have the gluten is a major learning process for these parents. So it becomes a very long kind of learning lesson for them, and they take sometimes a year or two to get it all together. But as they do this, as the parents start learning the different types of problems and working with a clinician who's doing the kind of work we do, then they can start reversing it. And we see that all the time. It's not an impossibility, and it doesn't require drugs. In fact, the children usually do better without all the drugs. Just get rid of those causes and don't worry about the symptoms. Symptoms take care of themselves.
Yeah. But like you said, some kids, they can turn it around overnight. Another one, it takes a little longer, though.
It can be a process. We've had children
to get that out of your system.
Just to get the yeast out. Imagine, you know, you have some candida overgrowth in the intestine. Can cause anything from, as far as gastrointestinal symptoms, from diarrhea to constipation to maybe not noticing anything. But the fact is that it's making little, what's called a leaky gut. It's letting little pseudopods go from the gut into the bloodstream and leak toxins into the blood and other particles from the gut can also leak in. So they kind of have a strong hold on that gut wall. And so after, sometimes it takes up to a year or longer to get rid of that yeast. And that's doing everything we know to do. And it's sometimes very difficult. These are tricky little organisms.
You know, I've had herbalists on the show too, and that's what they say, that the people today are so used to just getting an instant fix with a drug or something, and that the natural things do take longer, but they are more effective.
They work best in the long run. It all has to do with nutrition and supporting the body with what it needs. As you replace the yeast and move them out, you're also putting good bacteria back in, because the bacteria just aren't there. So it's a combination of processes of how you approach this for a person that pays off. And so part of it is you have to make sure, in this case, for yeast, that you're not getting sugar feeds yeast. So you have to watch all sugar sources. And again, it's a process. Sometimes it's easy to do. After a month or two, it's licked, at least for now, unless they get an antibiotic. Every time they get an antibiotic, got to make sure you have something to replace bacteria and treat the fungus.
Isn't there something natural that can be used in place of antibiotics?
Well, there are a lot of natural antibiotics out there, sure. And, you may be familiar with some of them. Depends on the what you're trying to treat, if it's a bacterial infection or actually for antibiotics, that's basically it. Viruses, there are very few antiviral drugs. They do have potential problems with them. You've got to kind of watch those anyway. So when it comes to yeast, again, there are only a handful of antifungals. Most of them that are used can affect the liver, so you have to do blood tests to make sure the liver is still functioning okay if you use them very long. We use a combination of things, but as far as natural antibiotics, things like olive leaf extract is an example. That's a very good one and can work for bacteria, virus, or fungus.
Yeah, I was thinking of encouraging the parents, instead of just getting a drug like an antibiotic, they might search and go to an herbalist or a naturopath or something, and somebody like yourself, and find something that would be natural.
Sure.
That's what I'm trying to encourage people to do.
Well, it actually ends up working better. When you're taking these antibiotics, a lot of them have some potent side effects that are not only creating yeast overgrowth. If you don't handle that while you're taking them, you're gonna pay for it later. But the fact is, there are also side effects for the chemical itself that the body does not like, and can cause all sorts of issues down the road. So we like to not use the chemical drugs unless we have no other choice. So we always try to find what is natural, what can help these.
Because there are times when there is an emergency and you don't really have a choice in a case like that.
It depends on how far something has progressed, right? And you can always do both. You can use something natural at the same time. We often do that. If it's an advanced case of some infection, for instance, we can do both because they work different ways anyway, and it just speeds the resolution up. I'd like to mention one more that has been found, one more issue, and that is if you look at the biochemistry in the body, it turns out a lot of these autistic spectrum children have a problem with being able to metabolize certain kinds or break down certain kinds of chemicals and rebuild them, such as, the deficits or the problems turn out to be things that are we don't even think about, like B vitamins. B vitamins have a lot to do with neurological function. Without them, you'd be missing a lot of how you think. So some of these children just cannot break them down and reform them correctly, so they end up needing vitamin, a lot of them, very common, need vitamin B6, vitamin B12, others are like folic acid. So we have found over, just empirically, by treating these children for many years now, doing this, and different research by some of the clinicians, that there are pathways in the biochemistry that get blocked, and these children just need to be given a particular vitamin that gets around the blockage so that then they can again form their brain neurochemicals so they can think again and act appropriately. Others that have been found, magnesium. Minerals like magnesium are very important.
Yeah, I'm always pushing magnesium because I found that really helped me.
It does help many people for many things. From muscle spasms, restless leg syndrome, can often just be magnesium deficiency.
High blood pressure.
High blood pressure is one, and it turns out in this case can help autism. So we do find that there are deficits like that in the minerals and vitamins that once you replace them, it starts helping, again, speed up the process of these children becoming normal. Or what we call normal. In other words, they fit in without all the behaviors that other people don't understand or find offensive.
Yeah, because like, what is normal, really?
Right.
But at least the parents would be a lot easier on them.
This is a hard job for the parents. I don't want to underplay that. It takes a lot of work and dedication to do all the things you have to do to get it right. Sometimes it's frustrating, and the parents will want to give up a little bit too early because their child just doesn't want to do without, you know, something they enjoy eating, or they just aren't turning around as quickly as they had hoped, or the yeast just, you know, 2 months later it's still there and haven't gotten rid of it.
Yeah.
And they got to keep giving this, going through a protocol or a process to get rid of it, but it's a lot of work. So, you know, months down the road, there may be small improvements, but it's not quite enough. And so the message then is, the parents are the key to this. The doctors like us that do this can only go so far. We can point out what we know and what the tests show will help. After that, it's really the parents who are the stars and the ones doing the jobs and helping their kids turn around.
But I think in some of those cases, even the small advances would be welcome. At least they could see something is happening.
We've noticed if the parents really put their mind to it and do a little educating before they even come to see the doctors, and the websites like that of the Autism Research Institute is a good example. There are resources there and other areas that will help them kind of learn beforehand what has to be done so that they don't come to the doctor and ask a basic question like, what is a gluten-free, casein-free diet and why does it work?
Yeah.
Well, if the doctor has to spend, you know, time spending on that, they don't have time to get deeper into issues specific for the child. So it kind of helps the parent to learn ahead of time, what is this about? Because, you know, my pediatrician says there's nothing to any of this, and, you know, so now you have to tell me what it's all about. No, that's not the best way to go about it. If you really want to learn it, you can. And then once you do, the doc can help guide you with the right tests and the right approach. And if the parents do that, then they find rather quickly, almost universally, these children start getting better. Within the first month, they're doing better, and it just escalates from there.
But before we go any further, do you want to give out the website that these people can look up?
Well, I would like to give this basic website, I think, would be a good idea.
Yeah.
Just so they will have a resource, because this is the group that started questioning all the theories 40 years ago. It's www.autism.com, and then /, and then ARI, which stands for Autism Research Institute. It's just ARI. So autism.com/ARI, and that's the website.
Mm.
There's a wealth of information. I think they'll be amazed on what really is known about this.
Because most of them are told there's nothing, anything, they can't do anything. You know?
We still get that, Dolores.
Oh, yeah, that people, you know, the doctors just say, well, that's it, you know.
Well, it's often the experts who say this, in quotes, I'll have to put that in quotes, sometimes the training we get as doctors kind of blinds us, I think. Once you get out of medical school and you've learned a certain way, it's hard to change that what you learned viewpoint, and it takes a lot of effort to get out of that box and those blinders.
What I always say, that it's not the doctor's fault. They're only practicing what they've been taught. It's to get them to look and think there is maybe something else that mm-hmm. they're not, don't know about, you know, just look a different direction.
That's right.
But they're only doing what they were taught, and they're kind of afraid to try something different, I think.
Well, that's true. A lot of the training is certainly there to work a certain way. And,
yeah.
And then you've got all the lawyer groups and agencies overlooking you, and I think they get afraid that if they get outside of the box too much, they might get in trouble or lose their license or whatever.
Yeah, I know. That's why I admire people like you, because you had the courage to get outside the box and think there is something else out there.
Well, I know there's something else out there. So I was glad to learn about this. how I started learning about it myself on autism. I'd already learned quite a bit about, quote, alternative or complementary medicine, unquote.
Yeah.
Was in the fall of 2003 when I started this my clinic. What I learned was I went to got a call from my dentist receptionist who happened to have an autistic child, and she said I'd really like you to go to this conference up in Portland, Oregon that's coming in another month. And so I had just started a clinic, so I was interested. I looked into it a little bit, and I went to that conference, and it was Autism Research Institute sponsored conference. They have them twice a year, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And what they and there are literally, I guess, probably 1,000 parents, 1,000 clinicians, nurses, doctors there each time at these conferences, and they're all exploring and sharing and giving what they've learned new that helps these issues and the new studies that have come out. And it's just very exciting to see what happens when a lot of dedicated people work on an issue like this.
Mm.
So I went to it, and within, a couple weeks, I was already seeing children using this approach. And have learned a lot since then, and every day we learn something new on it. There's always something else to learn on this issue.
It's kind of like cutting-edge research, really.
It's very much cutting-edge. There are a lot of very good doctors out there and researchers who are putting a lot of time and thought into this and coming up with new associations. Some of them... one of the laboratories that does some of the testing for the doctors who do this is Great Plains Laboratory. It's in Lenexa, Kansas. And the biochemist there, Dr. Shaw, has done a lot of good work. And what he is emphasizing now are something called oxalates. Oxalates are in foods that are like spinach, beets, peanuts, wheat bran, tea, things like that, almonds maybe. And these oxalates for some people can form a problem with genetically, you can have a problem with these particular oxalates. And so there's a genetic disease that says that if you have this oxalate concentration above a certain level, then you're going to have some real problems, and these can be very much neurological. In fact, antifreeze, the reason it's so toxic is because it converts over to oxalates. Well, it turns out that a researcher found out that if you give a diet low in oxalates, that it will often reduce the symptoms in these autistic spectrum children. And then if you do a little further studying, which has been done on this issue, it turns out that overall, if you look at autistic children, about 84% of these children on the autistic spectrum have oxalate values that are higher than the higher than the normal range by 2 standard deviations, which means they're way up there. So a third of the children, in fact, have values that are consistent with the diagnosis of genetic hyperoxalurea, which is what we were just discussing, too much oxalate in the body.
Yeah, these are things that can be verified with the laboratory tests.
Well, these are the laboratory tests. What does it do? Well, it just makes them autistic.
Yeah.
So that's a new finding, relatively new. So, again, there are lots of connections out here, and we're just beginning to really explore every one of them. We're lucky to have the ones we already know about, because we can make major progress in helping these children and the parents turn the kids around.
Well, is there a certain age that you can't help them after a certain age, or what?
Well,
anything like that.
There's not really an age where you can't help them. It becomes more difficult as the child gets older, so that if they're in their teens or 20s, by then One problem is they're set in their ways, and changing diets at that age becomes a lot harder than it is when the child's one or two or three.
Yeah.
Plus, they've had that many more years of exposure, say, to heavy metals to get in the brain and other toxins or yeast exposures that really, over time, damage the body and the brain and make it take longer to repair the damage, basically.
So it's easier if the child is younger if you start then.
It's easier when you're younger, but you can work on anybody, and we do. I've had one or two that were 30 years old, so we've tried some things with them. The younger the kid is, the quicker, no doubt about it, they recover and turn around.
What's to say with any adult, you know, even when they want to lose weight, it's very difficult to change their way of eating.
Well,
you know, so it goes along with that, too.
We don't. No, most of us have a resistance to changing the way we learned to eat when we were children, and we just enjoy it. And so it does take a lot of effort as we get older. So that's an example of how it becomes harder.
Well, I'm going to tell people where your clinic is in case anybody wants to contact you.
Well, if they were interested, I'm in near Nashville, Tennessee. We're in Brentwood, which is right next to Nashville. We're actually on the county line next to Nashville.
And I think there are getting to be more and more medical doctors who have gone over into this field.
It helps if the... It helps when the doctor sees a child who perhaps has been helped by another physician doing this. And then once they find out, well, I didn't think there was anything we could do for that kid, and here they are coming back, and the parents all excited, and they're telling me, look at what we did. And and if they actually they pay attention to that, a lot of times they will start looking into it, and then they go to a conference, and then they're hooked.
Yeah, I have a lot of clients coming to me who are medical doctors, and they decided they just don't want anything to do with the drugs anymore, and they want to get out of it.
It's common.
Yeah, because they're fed up with it because they see the side effects.
Yeah.
And they can see that it's not really helping anybody. It's just putting Band-Aids on things.
Well, Dolores, you're right.
Fixes, but... I think I'm seeing more and more of them anyway that are realizing they want to go over into the natural field.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
think in spite of what the medical associations are saying, I think the natural field is growing.
No doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's more money spent on natural alternative complementary methods of healing from massage therapy to chiropractic to acupuncture to naturopathy than there is out of all the out-of-pocket paid for hospitals and doctor visits in the country each year. So,
yet the medical profession, the association is trying to make people think there isn't anything to it.
Well, they can say that, but then the Journal American Medical Association did a study 2 years ago showing that it's increasing, and that's what it showed.
Maybe that's why they're afraid, and they're pushing all these drugs on TV all the time.
Well, the drug companies have a lot to do with making money for themselves and not really caring. There have been books written on that issue.
Yeah, because I also have clients that come to me who work for the drug companies, so I hear it out of the horse's mouth, too, But I think it is kind of like a fear there that for some reason the medical, not the doctors, the big, the heads, mm-hmm. they're worried that people are going more over to the alternative.
Well,
they try to plant that fear there. Well, this is proven and all of that,
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a joke on TV. They'll say, well, no, we haven't, FCC hasn't tested this herb or whatever. We don't know if it's safe. And I said, yeah, it's only been around for 3,000 years, but because they haven't tested it, they don't think it's safe.
Well, unfortunately or fortunately, I think more unfortunately in a lot of ways, most of the herbs, if you use them correctly, they are certainly the odds of them having a problem for you or a reaction to them are minuscule. There's very little problem with them. Once in a while, because someone just reacts to it, everyone's an individual, we're all genetically a little bit different, so sometimes it's a problem. So you still treat them with respect. But I'll guarantee you that you can give 100 people, all of them herbs of different types, and almost none of them will have any side effect or much of any reaction to it. Certainly no death. Whereas if you give that same 100 people 3 or 4 different drugs, 60 to 80% will have some side effect or reaction to it, and maybe once in a while you'll have somebody die from the drug. In fact, a statistic, not a statistic, but if you look at Tylenol and ibuprofen or Advil, those kinds of drugs over the counter.
Yeah, on the news tonight they're talking about Advair.
Okay.
It's
well,
another one they're saying has got, they're finding out bad side effects.
Well, that's not unusual. I hadn't seen that one yet.
It was just on the news a while ago.
Okay.
You know, my company just published this huge herbal encyclopedia. I mean, it's big. It's dictionary size.
Mm-hmm.
As all the herbs there are in it. And the herbalist, I've had her on the show, and she was talking about how the doctors took the active ingredient from the herb and made it into a drug. But what they didn't realize is when they did that, there was something else in the herb that helped it keep it from having side effects.
That's correct. And that's
they didn't take that part. They was not taking the whole herb. They're just taking out that one active ingredient.
And that's how the drug companies can patent the medicine to make their money.
Yeah.
So they do that thinking, oh, this is what it is, and it may have something that will help, a symptom. But what happens is the synergism, the ingredients combined, have a far greater effect than one little isolated piece out of it. And that's also where maybe the protection of the herb is compared with the drug. These are not very concentrated chemicals. They're more dispersed, so you get a gentler approach over time with many of them combined in a herb, not a drug that just takes one ingredient, goes and patents it, and now that's the end of it. That's where the side effects come in.
Yeah, that was what she's saying. I thought that was interesting that it's almost like the herb, it knows what it's doing because it cancels out side effects if you use the whole herb correctly then.
That's right.
I thought that was interesting, though.
Mm-hmm.
But is there, we got about 5 more minutes.
Okay.
Is there any advice you'd give for people, anything that they need in their diet or in their body?
Well, in general, and this is all getting back to the autistic kids, the spectrum.
Yeah.
Is that one thing that early on seems to be a problem for whether it's an autism spectrum child or just anyone who doesn't have that syndrome, is that the milk dairy is often a big problem as we grow up. And although people seem to, in this country especially, are really almost addicted to it, with cheese and ice cream and all the different things that can come from dairy.
Yeah.
They by and large are one of the major problems for many, many problems, from ear infections, which really aren't infections, they're allergies to milk protein, and they close up the little eustachian tube that drains the middle ear, and so fluid builds up and it looks like an infection, so they get an antibiotic. Well, you just get the kids off the milk and they don't have the ear infections anymore, quote, ear infections.
Okay.
So that's an example of a food. It has problems. We just can't digest it well. It's pasteurized, which destroys the enzymes and the good stuff in it. So it's basically a dead food for us, and our bodies just don't like it. Mm-hmm. So that's one that's been clearly shown over time. Others are, they're just common issues for all of us. If you look at the whole field of nutrition, most of us have a problem not getting enough vegetables and fruit in.
That's what I was going to say. fresh vegetables is usually a good idea.
You have to have these. They should be ones that are closer to the fields being organic, if possible. That's sometimes hard to do, but
yeah.
Certainly vegetables and fruit have turned out to be, because of all the antioxidants, the fiber, the many benefits in these foods, can prevent, and head studies have shown, are related to the longest lived people, the best health, the fewest cancers. This is where the main emphasis should be, along with the right kind of proteins.
Yeah.
And
but also, my homeopath was telling me that, what is it, about 80-90% of the people don't have enough magnesium in their system.
Well, what I have, most of the patients I see for every situation, we basically make sure that they're getting some sort of a mineral replacement, and magnesium is one of the common ones that's very deficit. There's a great deficit for. And the reason is because if you look in the farming over the last 50, 60 years, farmers will till down as far as the blades on the tiller go, and that might go down a foot or so, and then they'll replace the nitrogen fertilizer, but nobody replaced the minerals in the soil. So we're growing all these grains and foods of different types, and there are no minerals in them. We all have deficits in minerals.
Yeah, because that's what people say, I'm getting all I need from the food I eat.
No.
But that they don't realize that the food is different than it used to be.
That's right. A whole different era than now.
Okay, well, we're coming up to the time, but I do want, this is Dr. Tony Chastelain, and does your clinic have a name, or is it just your name if people want to look it up?
Well, it's General and Alternative Medicine.
And that's the name of the clinic?
Yes.
Just outside of Nashville.
Right.
In Brentwood, did you say?
Brentwood, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And the give out the website one more time for the autistic
Sure.
Institute.
This is well worth, if you have a child who's in this spectrum or thought to be, or you just wonder, go to this site and you'll get a lot of information and help. It's www.autism.com/ARI.
And that's for Autism Research Institute.
That's what it stands for, Autism Research.
Oh, okay. I think this is valuable information. That's why I wanted to have you on the show. And, Tony, it's an honor. I'm really glad that you did come on. People need this information.
Well, thank you, Dolores.
They need
enjoyed it.
To know that there is hope. It's not a hopeless situation.
There's lots of hope. We see it every day.
Okay. All well, right. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you.
And good night, everyone.
Hi, everybody. This is Senior Seaver, and you're listening to Dr. Bell. Well, I forgot to say who I am. Sorry about that.
Yeah, go ahead. We'll keep that done. Be sure and keep that in there. I like those improvs. Yeah, go ahead. Especially with a laugh and all that.
Yeah. Who am I? I just forgot.
Pulls me gently like a sunlit light. by and emptier, emptier on the inside. I'm a quarter acre, I'm not old but older, and my strokes are blue, paint on longer and bolder as time rushes on. I keep writing the same song. This sweet smoke, it pulls me gently like a sunlit lullaby. The beat sounded through this city like a moonlit midnight sky. But every night there's one breath where but it's no break, ain't so different than when I'm only, ain't so different than when I'm only, ain't so different than when I'm only, ain't so different than when I'm only.
The joy.